Hello, this is Science Weekly. I'm Alok Jha. On this week's podcast, the only headline that manages to fuse together three slang terms from male genitalia, Johnson Sacks Nut.
He has a view on relative harms, which I don't share. He has a view about ecstasy, which I don't share. He has a view about cannabis, which I don't share, and the majority of this house doesn't share.
Uproar as the UK government sacks one of its top science advisors. We'll examine what this episode says about the relationship between science and the government. Do politicians only listen to experts when their advice falls into line with policy?
The council isn't functioning. Its work will be very difficult because people won't know whether they're saying what the government wants them to say or what they want to say. So I think it's frankly fatally flawed.
Plus, is it all over for the Copenhagen climate talks? And the man in charge of the Large Hadron Collider tells us about the moment he found out something had gone horribly, horribly wrong.
I got a call on my mobile to say that something bad had gone wrong. So I immediately went over to the control room, and as soon as I walked in, I could see all the alarm screens, you know, showing faults.
Well, at least it didn't rip a hole in the space-time continuum. This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. Welcome, everyone. In the pod for the first time, and I don't know why we've not done this before, is the Observer's science editor, Robin McKee. In case you don't know, that's our sister paper on Sundays. Environment correspondent David Adam is here too. Before we start, I'm going to ask you both for your favourite ever scientific discovery. This is after the Science Museum announced that in a poll, it had found that the X-ray was the most important scientific discovery of all time, followed by penicillin, DNA double helix. Robin, what would you say is your favourite or most important scientific discovery?
Well, what's the most important bit of technology ever to change my life? I still think the Post-it sticker. That's the one.
The Post-it note?
The Post-it note, yeah. I still use
them. Is that a scientific discovery?
Yeah, it is. Yeah, the glue in the back of it's very, very special kind of glue. You know, it doesn't stick and
leave
and
a residue.
Leave a residue and won't come away. It's just that absolute level of just peel it off. Fantastic. I still use them.
Look at the poetics on the post-it. David, what about you?
Wasn't it? Well, I'm going to say the flushing toilet, and I was going to say that, as we all know, it was invented by Mr. Thomas Crapper. Turns out it wasn't. The extensive research reveals that Thomas Crapper was a Victorian engineer in sanitary works, but he did not invent the toilet. He did invent a number of other sanitary and plumbing accessories, but not the flushing toilet.
And if you go to Wikipedia, you'll find exactly those words that David's just said. Thanks, guys. Now, science has been making all the headlines for the past week in the UK, but possibly for all the wrong reasons. David Nutt, the government's chief drug advisor, was sacked a day after claiming ecstasy and LSD were less dangerous than alcohol. The Home Secretary asked Professor Nutt to resign as chair of the Advisory Council on the Misuse of Drugs. But Nutt didn't go quietly, and the man who sacked him, Alan Johnson, had a heated reception in the House of Commons over his handling of the affair.
I asked Professor Nutt to resign as my principal drugs advisor, not because of the work of the council, but because of his failure to recognise that as chair of ACMD, his role is to advise rather than criticise government policy on drugs. I have lost confidence in Professor Nutt's ability to be my principal advisor on drugs.
Mr. Chris Hume, the government does not want evidence, and the official opposition wants even less evidence, even more quickly. The government relies on objective, impartial, and unpaid advice from leading experts on everything from nuclear safety to mad cow disease.
Home Secretary.
Piety and pomposity in equal measure. Listen, this government, and I would say me in particular, have listened to scientific advice. We took through the Human Fertilisation Embryology Bill. There was an awful lot of science in that. We respect the views of scientists. We have respected the views of scientists in every aspect of government policy.
Dr. Evan Harris.
If an advisor is appointed, if a scientist is appointed a government advisor, but is then told what he says is dependent on the government's policy, how can he be an independent scientist advising the government?
Home Secretary.
I didn't say that, but what a government advisor should not do is to get, once a decision has been made on their recommendations, that's it. They should get on with being the government's advisor, not continually return to that decision and seek to undermine the government's framework. That is quite wrong.
You then couldn't escape the story on TV and in the papers for the next few days, as everyone debated the role of science in government and in informing drugs policies. A few days after the sacking, this is what the man at the centre of all this had to say. Here's Professor Nutt.
I think most scientists would prefer an independent body, a body that then says, these are the harms of drugs, we'll rate them on these scales, and we'll come up with a classification system. We think this is an appropriate classification system, and then you, the government, you go away and you decide on what the appropriate penalties are. Politicians cannot decide on harms, they can only decide on matters which are in their province. If I was a politician, I'd do what they did. I'd try to take it out of the scientific arena and say it's just some advisor acting out. No, I mean, that's quite wrong. All I have done is portray the science correctly and portray the views of the council correctly. And I'm sure the council will make that clear to him.
Professor David Nutt there. Okay, Robin, David, let's go through some of this. The timeline of all of this is kind of stretches over years. I mean, the first time that David Nutt was sort of slapped down by the government was by Jackie Smith, the Home Secretary before Alan Johnson, when she kind of disagreed with his advice on cannabis. So the government knew that David Nutt thought that cannabis shouldn't have been regraded as a Class B substance. He'd said that a year before. Is this normal for politicians to be so vocally against their scientific advisors?
Very rarely do scientific issues impinge, I think, on society as much as the use of drugs or the misuse of drugs. So I think that's a special part of this. So that's clearly the most important aspect of this. The issue is really not that he ignored Nutt's advice, but the fact that he chose to sack him in a very public and, I would say, completely unnecessary manner, thus pandering, one assumes, to the right-wing press. And that's really the issue that goes here. It was a political decision made by spin doctors, I'm sure. And has it done the government any harm? Has it done the government any good? They'll only consider this in political terms, not in scientific terms.
So you think this might not have happened if there wasn't a general election in the next 6 months?
I would say that was a very important part of it, crucial, in fact.
Yeah, because, again, like we said, this issue came up a year ago and he was just told to apologise rather than actually sacked.
I mean, he never met Jackie Smith in all his time in office, and the only time he ever heard from her was when she phoned up to say how outraged she was over his remarks about ecstasy and horse riding. He chose to make a very public and rather humiliating apology because he wanted to continue his work on that committee. He felt it was vital and important. And he's gone, you know, this time he's gone down fighting because he still believes that. And still believes that independent scientific advice is crucial to what's going to be becoming an increasing problem for this country.
So that was the situation where he'd said in public that horse riding is actually, well, kills more people than ecstasy, which is statistically very true. And one might argue that actually that's a silly comparison to make. But, you know, if you're thinking about harm, then he's actually right. Let's step back a bit, though. What role do scientific advisors have in government? Because this government has been all about evidence-based policy since the beginning.
It paid great lip service to it, given the sort of debacles that have happened in the past. I think it was good. I mean, the worst obvious example is the BSE crisis, when basically the government advisors were telling ministers that, you know, look, there could be a problem here. And politicians and the public have a great deal of difficulty with whether could or is consistent with, might or probably. All these kind of words are difficult for the public and for politicians to accept. The real issue is they want a cast iron guarantee that eating beef was safe. And scientific advisors really couldn't give that. And the fact that we didn't get that message in public, it was frankly a disgrace. And of course, then when it turned out there was a small risk and people would die, then the scientists involved were, you know, extremely embarrassed, and the whole scientific community was compromised in that sense.
And in the late 90s, after all this happened and after all this came out, the then chief scientific advisor, Bob May, made a lot of effort to try and systematically make sure that the government used scientific advice properly or in consistent ways, or at least made sure that the scientists themselves were independent. What kind of effect did that have?
Largely, it was a lot to do with Bob May's personality. He's a very forceful Australian, who's way of dealing with civil servants he doesn't like is to call them fuckwits. You said I could swear.
Yes.
Yeah, that's all right.
Fuckwits, you said.
Yeah, fuckwits, okay. and it was much of his personality that drove this through, and I think the message slowly went through government. But there were, you know, not without its travails, shall we say.
David, so BSE was one of the places where scientific advice seemed to fail. Another one perhaps was genetically modified crops. We don't have them in this country because of the media furore in the early 2000s, basically. Was that another case where the scientific advice didn't get through to politicians?
I'm not sure that the two are comparable. I think with GM it was far more complex than just a simple message of harm or safety. I think with GM there were a number of social issues and environmental issues and economic issues that all intertwined, and it was represented as science, but it wasn't really. It was more a case of a risk benefit, I think, and the public saw all of the risks and none of the benefits, and you could argue maybe that that's probably true for Britain. But I think just one thing I wanted to say, it's interesting that I remember interviewing David King just after he'd started being Bob May's successor as chief scientist to the government. And the first thing that happened to him, literally within days of taking office, was foot and mouth. And I remember being struck by the way David King spoke about the way he had given his advice to Tony Blair. And he said something like, you know, when I presented my policy to the Prime Minister, and I remember thinking, hang on, that's not your job. Your job is to suggest policy in the government, well, not even to suggest policy, to point out
give
what would
data,
happen
yeah.
with various policy options. And he's since spoken in very strong terms about how he came in as a scientist and solved the crisis, because I don't know if you remember, he introduced this idea of contiguous culling,
yeah.
which just slaughtered millions and millions and millions of animals. We'll remember the fires. And and I think he that, for right or wrong, became a sort of a very early benchmark that he set in his role in his time as science advisor. And I think Blair took that on board very strongly, and I think the clip we heard of Alan Johnson talking about the embryology bill is right to an extent. There was a great deal of scientific input, and we had one of the most educated and informed and well-balanced debates anywhere in the world on that, and the resulting legislation, I think, reflected that.
Yeah, Robin, I mean, the HFEA bill was a great example of how the government, politicians, everyone took scientific advice properly and seriously.
But that wasn't the government. That was a free vote in the House of Commons, wasn't it? And that was really that was the House reacting.
Let me say politicians took it seriously then.
Yes, as opposed to the government. And this was, you know, members of Parliament deciding this was a crucial issue, and individual MPs talking to scientists and finding out for themselves and having, I mean, it was a great credit to MPs. That's really one of these examples, I think, in this country.
And
they did it well.
Not without some effort by individual scientists sitting down with MPs, hundreds of them.
Yes, exactly. Science Media Centre, everybody, you know, moved in on it. But this wasn't a government behaving sensibly, other than it allowed the free vote and the MPs came to what we would all think as the correct decision.
Okay, well, I suppose you're right. The key issue there was that the advice did not contravene an existing policy.
Yes.
Well, having said that, Caroline Flint, the then health minister, was about to ban hybrid embryos. And that was one of the issues of the HFEA bill. She for some reason had decided that hybrid embryos, the idea of, you know, making more embryos from human and animal cells combined so that you get more sort of research stem cells, was a bad thing. Somehow it was a bad thing. Maybe, again, it was the Daily Mail that made her do it. And that was a key amendment that was overturned. But generally, yes, the government wanted to go forward with the stem cell therapy.
Yeah, it did. And I think another example worth talking about is the one that I talk about or write about all the time, which is climate change. And this is where the government is very keen to be seen as basing its policies on science, which it does to an extent in the general terms. But when it comes to actual decision making, this is when science has to jostle with economics and social awareness and acceptance and politics and all of that stuff. And I do think it's a little unfair to criticise politicians for doing politics. I mean, we all think and appreciate the value of science, but we don't have to live with the consequences of the decisions every day in the way that politicians do. And I think it's quite right that scientists give advice and point out what would happen if that scientific advice is not followed. But I do think there's an issue about directly criticising policy, because science is not the only input, and drugs especially is such a loaded, sensitive area that we don't just care about the number of people that drugs kill. In terms of setting policy, we care about the social acceptance and the awareness and the economic influences. So alcohol is taxed very heavily. There's a great deal of money that comes in, and it's naive, I think, to think that politicians should not take those into account.
The issue is, should you sack the man who gives the advice?
Well, exactly.
That's really the issue here. It's not that he gave advice that the government not wants to say, I will give advice, and if they ignore it because there are other social issues, I will accept that. But that's not what they did. They sacked him.
But do you think that, Robin, that if as David says, the government has to take into account all sorts of other things, and that's understandable, if they do go against scientific advice, that they should explain why?
Yes, precisely. By doing this, they don't have to explain why. They just stop the advice coming in, and so they don't quite look so contrarian and so pandering to the right-wing press, which is, of course, what they are doing.
Well, let's talk about what happens to the Advisory Council on the Misuse of Drugs now. So it's lost its chair, plus two other expert members. So the rest of the members are meeting with Alan Johnson, the Home Secretary, later this week. What's going to happen, do you think?
I think there'll be more resignations. It's a matter of... they've put certain demands to Alan Johnson, and... they're seeking reassurances, and some of them will say, well, we'll wait till he gives us those reassurances, or wait to see if he will give those reassurances, and I suspect that one or two others won't wait.
But what weight do those assurances he might give have? Given that he's just sacked their chairman.
Exactly. But I think they take the view that it would be impolite and impolitic to do otherwise.
Moving on to what David Nutt was saying, when David Nutt gave a briefing last week, he sort of talked about some of the stuff that now is in danger of not being done by the ACMD because of this sort of distraction. He talked about reviews on ketamine and this new emerging drug called Spice. But his big thing seems to be alcohol. He said that one of the reasons he hasn't gone quietly this time round is that he wants to raise the issue or force a debate on alcohol. He said that alcohol is going to be the biggest killer within a decade, bigger than cardiovascular disease in the UK, and that people just don't want to talk about this. He wants to triple the price of alcohol. How important is that debate to have?
I think it's a crucial debate, yes. Where I stand on it, it's a difficult thing.
Where do you stand on it?
I would hate to see drink tripled in price. but then I'm a Scottish journalist, I might have to say that.
Well, we'll leave that there for now. You can join our Facebook group and post a comment on the wall, or leave your thoughts on the blog at guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly. And we'll also put a link to all the articles about David Nutt on the blog too. Let's take a look now at some of the other science stories around this week.
News Jack. Hopes are fading for a Copenhagen climate change treaty, and that's according to Britain's climate change secretary. Ed Miliband now says that a political agreement rather than a full treaty is now the goal of the summit. He's told MPs the government would have preferred a full treaty, but any deal that emerges from the talks must contain detailed commitments.
Babies born to women who have taken folic acid supplements during their pregnancy are up to 30% more likely than other children to develop asthma. The latest research claims its findings may help explain the huge global rise over the last 50 years in asthma, which has puzzled experts and led to speculation over the causes of the increase. But while the intake of folic acid supplements in later pregnancy was potentially problematic, intake of folate, the natural form of folic acid, through consumption of green leafy vegetables and certain nuts and fruits involved no risk.
The fossilised skull of a sea monster, which may be the largest of its type ever found, has been unearthed on the Dorset coast. The skull from the ferocious prehistoric predator, the plesiosaur, is 2.4 metres long and could belong to a creature measuring up to 16 metres in length, weighing up to 12 tonnes. Experts say the discovery is fortunate because these kind of skulls are generally found crushed flat.
And the Southern African Large Telescope has been hit by broadband problems. The £25 million internationally renowned science facility is able to see the edge of the observable universe, but can't send its findings anywhere. Its astronomers have found download speeds so slow that they're forced to send their cosmic discoveries by road. It can capture data 10 billion light years away, but the telescope's 11 miles short of the nearest fibre optic internet cable. back in September to illustrate the problem. A pigeon called Winston beat Telecom's broadband service when he carried a 4GB memory stick from Howick to Durban in 2 hours, in which time the ADSL line had sent just 4% of the data.
David, let's talk about climate change, your favourite topic. You sound down about it. No, Ed Miliband says we're not going to get a deal in Copenhagen. Is that a surprise to anyone but news desks?
Well, gosh, I mean, you have to put it all into context in the fact that although Copenhagen seems to emerge like a giant iceberg from the sea, it's actually, there's an awful lot been going on before and will continue to go on afterwards. And what we're seeing here is a little bit of a reality biting, a little bit of expectations being managed, and a little bit of us just trying to find a way to write about Copenhagen before it happens again. Because in reality, although the UN did set a deadline for a treaty to be finished in Copenhagen, they set that 2 years ago, as long ago as a year ago, people were saying it's not going to happen, there isn't enough time. So the idea that you could leave Copenhagen and everything was signed was never really going to happen. There's also a semantic issue here, because when Ed Miliband says we're not going to get a treaty, but we want a deal, they're effectively the same thing, because a deal in his mind is everyone coming together and agreeing to do lots of really difficult stuff, getting all of the difficult negotiations out of the way, America signing on, China signing on, lots of money being agreed. That's pretty much 99% of what most people would call a treaty. What it isn't is it's all the legal minutiae, which is going to take months just for the lawyers to work through.
So just go through that, actually, in just a little bit more detail. What's the difference between a political treaty and the legal treaty? I mean, is it...
I'm no international environment lawyer, but as I understand it, a political deal or political agreement is effectively all of the numbers in place, all of the commitments in place, but if you don't stick to that commitment, then there's no comeback, there's no penalty, whereas once it is legally enshrined under international law, there are penalties. And so in a sense, it's about the bindingness of it. We all know that politicians have, from time to time, walked away from commitments that they have made. It's very difficult to walk away from an internationally agreed treaty.
Robin, you've followed this for a long time. What was this a surprise to you?
Given that I interviewed him 7 days before he made that statement and he said he was looking for a legally binding treaty, he must have had a bit of a conversion.
Did he wink at you when he said it?
No. He gazed, looked me straight in the eye and told me that. Make what you will of that. Obviously, he had a bad time in Barcelona, I think, or a harsh dose of reality there. I mean, I think when he said we want a legally binding treaty, he's trying to sort of G the thing up and force people to look at it. But it never even seemed realistic last week that he was ever going to get that.
So this might be a bit of brinkmanship. David, is there some hope for optimism with this, actually? Because if we don't get a deal in Copenhagen, it means that the talks carry on maybe for another 6 or 7 months, which gives enough time for the US to get its own climate change legislation through Congress, which means then that Obama can actually negotiate internationally. Whereas until then, their hands are tied.
Yeah, yes and no. In a sense, it's an arbitrary deadline. The reason it was set for this year was because Kyoto Protocol, the existing treaty, the first phase of that runs out in 2012. The idea is that you need to get something agreed and then ratified. That might take a few years. So if you want something coming into place immediately the moment Kyoto finishes, you need to get it agreed pretty much now. But if you think, well, maybe we're not going to get that seamless transition and maybe it's not that important, then this deadline melts away a little bit. And this is the danger, because once it starts slipping, then these are really, really difficult political decisions. And once it starts slipping, it's far easier for them to be postponed than taken. And this is why people like Ed Miliband and the Brits are very, very keen to keep the pressure up for Copenhagen, because without pressure, the whole thing just dissolves.
Okay, well, if you want to know more about that, go to guardian.co.uk/environment, where there'll be pages and pages and pages of this for the next few months.
And why wouldn't you want to know more about it?
Why wouldn't you want to know? There's interactive graphics, all sorts of stuff. Anyway, guardian.co.uk/environment.
Science Weekly from guardian.co.uk with Alok Jha.
Will it be second time lucky for the Large Hadron Collider? Excitement is once again building as CERN prepares to get its new and improved particle collider working again. It's been a year since the meltdown, a glitch that has cost £30 million to repair. Science correspondent Ian Sample went to meet the man in charge of the collider, project leader Lynn Evans. Here, Lynn recalls the moment he found out something had gone horribly wrong.
I remember I was actually over in the personnel department haggling about some triviality. And I got a call on my mobile to say that something bad had gone wrong. So I went over to the control room. And as soon as I walked in, I could see all the alarm screens, you know, showing faults, many, many faults on the magnets, the vacuum system, etc. It was obviously a serious problem. We also had alarms coming out of the tunnel that there was helium venting into the tunnel. Clearly it was something very big. So then we assembled a crisis unit to decide what to do. I mean, in a situation like that, first of all, to understand what happened. So we sent a few people into the tunnel. One has to be very careful with safety, of course. If there is helium in the atmosphere, helium itself is not poisonous, but you can't. It excludes the oxygen. So first we sent the fire brigade in there with a breathing equipment, and then when the tunnel had vented enough, the oxygen was re-established, then we could go in, and we found a very bad situation: icing up on the magnets. Clearly, there had been we put the picture together rather quickly, although we had several months of inquiry afterwards. What had happened was that one of the soldered joints, the brazed joints between two magnets, had failed catastrophically. Now, there are 10,000 of these in the machine, and one of them had failed, which meant that it opened up, produced an electrical arc, and this is all inside the liquid helium vessel, pierced the container, the containment tube, and then vented helium into the magnets. And the pressure of the helium got so high, first of all, the pressure relief valves opened, so helium went into the tunnel, but even they could not cope with the volume of helium. And that was the big problem, is that the pressure went up too high, and this actually pushed magnets off their supports. Wow. Because every 200 meters we have a vacuum barrier, which is to separate the vacuum of one sector from another, and if you've got vacuum on one side of that barrier and four atmospheres of pressure on the other, then there is a longitudinal force of about 15 ton. That pushes these, and that this is what did the most of the damage. It was not the actual the incident itself, but the collateral damage because of the high pressures.
Lynn Evans there talking to Ian Sample. Robin, you've been in Geneva recently, and you actually got to see the offending piece of kit that actually did all of this damage.
Yeah, it's a little piece of copper piping with a cable running through it that it's cooled to 1.9 degrees above absolute zero, so it can carry the current without resistance, and is vital to running the magnets there. And there was a shortage across one of them, and that was what triggered the whole damage.
Have they mounted it on wood to sort of make sure that there's no more hubris? Because they didn't start this thing quietly last year.
No, they had a great blowout, as it were. on today, where when they decided they would get the first beams in by 8:30 in the morning, just in time for the listeners on today. And no, there won't be this anymore. It'll be quietly. Well, it's already starting. Little bits of beam are being put in. So they'll be over the next 6 weeks, they'll be slowly winding the thing up, cranking it
so
up.
So they've already sent some stuff around. It's working.
It's not all the way around, but in some arcs of it. Yeah, and they will, one quadrant of it, and they will get it up and have one beam right round and then beam round the other way, and then they'll get them to meet and then they'll start cranking the energies up.
When can we sort of expect the first collisions and the first bits of science?
Collisions, hopefully before Christmas. Science, that's a very good one. That's, most people say a year. before you get any meaningful results that said, have we got a Higgs boson or whatever.
What's the mood like over there? I mean, like you said, they're not doing the big sort of launches this time around, but are they fingers crossed, or are they confident that it'll work this time?
I think they're less cocky than they were a year ago. Well, what was it? It was September last year. I think it was a very bad time just before Christmas last year. They were really down. I think they're you know, quietly confident. The emphasis on the word quiet.
I mean, aren't they also worried that the longer they leave it, the more likely that Fermilab with its Tevatron eats away into its possibility of finding the Higgs boson? And it might just find it in its last gasp.
It just might do that. That is always that tantalizing. But the energy range that the LHC has got is so vastly superior to Fermilab's that whatever happens, they're going to get new physics out of LHC that they won't get out of Fermilab. And there's something, you know, great things are going to come out of this, if as long as it doesn't blow a gasket again.
So in terms of when you went down there, what else did they show you? Did they show you how they've repaired it and the things that went wrong?
Yes, they have a little sort of display cabinet in one of the halls to point out where things went wrong and how they've got, you know, why they were pushing the science so much and the technology so much, why they had to do it. That's really all they've got, because you can't go down into the tunnel. The tunnel's sealed and it's cooled and everything. So it's only little bits and pieces left over is all they've got to show at the moment.
Well, we'll keep listeners updated with all this stuff over the next few months. But I just wanted to finish with a quote from Robin's piece, which was in The Observer last week. It says, "The LHC uses as much energy as an aircraft carrier at full speed. When you release that energy suddenly, you do a lot of damage." Everything about this machine is amazing. If you want to hear more from project leader Lynn Evans, you can hear Ian Sample's full interview as the latest Science Weekly Extra podcast. You'll find that at guardian.co.uk/Science Weekly or on the iTunes feed.
Science Weekly.
Right, well, that's it for this week. My thanks to David Adam and to Robin McKee. Robin, did you enjoy this? Would you do this again?
Oh, yes, anytime.
Yeah? Okay, excellent. We'll make sure there's alcohol here next time, if you like.
On a Friday morning, that's just what I need, yes.
That's exactly right. Okay, don't forget to add your voice to our debate at guardian.co.uk/Science Weekly. This podcast was produced by Andy Duckworth. I'm Alok Jha. Thanks for listening. On this week's podcast, the only headline that manages... What? What? I didn't see that in the script before. The only headline that manages to fuse together three slang terms for male genitalia: Johnson Sachs nut.
Oh,
who wrote that? I'm not reading that out.
Oh.
No. It's a serious discussion about scientific advice in government. That's ridiculous. You can't put that in. That's terrible. Oh, God. That's good, though. It's good. Yeah, it's good.